So this is going to be a talk presentation. I have only two figures, and I will invoke them when I need them. And largely what we're going to do here, this is a paper that Mark Padilla and I are writing together. As the MC mentioned, we've worked overseas for many, many years and are now working in Detroit, and both keep spilling over one another the number of questions this has raised for many of us about what's global health, what are we doing in Detroit that's different from in Africa or Latin America, and that's the paper I'm going to share with you today. Okay? All right. So in recent decades, global health has gained a really prominent position, certainly in academic settings. All sorts of new training initiatives are underway worldwide. And unlike its predecessors, international health and tropical medicine, many scholars have suggested that global health is special. It's different. It has a new set of values that are associated with it. And what's important to some authors is that it moves us away from a sort of core and periphery kind of bipolar approach to developed and developing countries. And this is argued as really important for three basic reasons. First, they point out that this is totally outdated because the world, of course, is very much globalized. There's a massive expansion and interconnection of both ideas and resources, and open trade has led to lots of material commonalities in our world in quite diverse settings. We all know what it's like to be somewhere in Mali and you come across not Coca-Cola but a whole set of, you know, the latest video productions that are you know, in Boston. This kind of thing is happening all the time now. And we really see media as this very global conduit, not only for entertainment, but in our work on sexual and health, particularly around HIV. It's also very much a medium for conveying and sharing social, lifestyle, and identity messaging that's very much embedded with notions of gender, sexuality, and health. And while globalization discourse in the context of our global health work sort of implies that national and regional boundaries are becoming blurred, we are going to make the case today that the nation state very much still shapes what we're calling global health research. And the preview of that is the slide that's up, and I'll get to it in a moment, but I think you can see where this is just one example of where we're going. Second, quite a few critics have asserted that old models presumed that developed countries, of course most often conceived as the Western countries, were really the exporter of the tried and true solutions, and developing countries were much more the recipients. I won't go through Foster and Brown and a number of people who've been writing about this, but in essence the argument was, okay, there were these sort of silver platter models. We all know that those didn't work extremely well. It was sort of vertical solutions and programs being imposed, the West to the rest. But there was very little in these arguments that international health enabled in terms of reciprocal or sort of bi-directional shaping and learning. So where were the opportunities where an example from a very poor country actually created and informed and shaped the culture of a solution for a first world health problem? And third, social scientists have argued for quite a while that international health collaborations inevitably replicate the power differentials between collaborating rich and poor institutions as well as countries. And that in many respects, a sort of focus on appropriate technology, and this comes from my Ghanaian graduate student who's furious about appropriate technology debates, argues that, okay, appropriate technology, you keep talking about creating some sort of energy efficient, but in fact low class mechanism that by which we can be helped, when in fact if you would simply build our public health schools and strengthen them, and our engineering schools, we can sort of take care of solutions that are appropriate to us and make those decisions and definitions ourselves. I mean, I think this is a political discourse we're all familiar with, but we do want to press it, interrogate this a bit more. Indeed, health programs are pretty often arguably pretty small or too curtailed to sort of redress all of the structural systems that I think many of us recognize are the fundamental causes of health disparities. But our question in our paper is whether a global health approach, reconceived, but operating absolutely at a transnational level and emphasizing co-equality and focusing on broader generalizations of social change and the trends one can observe across the world, might very simply encourage a much deeper examination of the structural causes of ill health abroad, but also, of course, in the United States. Structural critiques as global health, and Paul Farmer's work certainly stands out as an important illustration of this, emphasize the need to reflect on the global opportunities through which multilateral institutions like the UN, university global health centers and programs, which were described, many of which we represent, and transnational biomedical institutions operate, and to the extent to which our own global health research actually makes important contributions to a global discourse of health inequality. So, what might a global health paradigm offer? It's often understood as a means of addressing some of these critiques. In fact, I would say lately global health is almost taken on a kind of evangelical tone, where it attracts a lot of scholars and seems to promise a new way of thinking about public health delivery. Brown and his colleagues did argue that this was really created as a concept. They sort of tracked it since the 90s and showed how it's often, I mean, increasingly mentioned and used as a terminology. They argue about the WHO's political sort of position kind of engendering this move as they were anxious about the Gates Foundation. But I think that's sort of immaterial to the point. I think regardless of its roots, it is really clear that global health has not just become a discursive phenomenon. It's really driving resources. I think Monica put up a very nice slide in the first piece on $600 billion or something extraordinary. But it's certainly pushing educational demand. And for anyone in a university right now who's got a Center for Global Health, the number of students who want to, in fact, be trained and be given that sort of professional legitimacy as scholars and practitioners is impressive and perhaps unsettling how increasingly they describe themselves as global health specialists. Ponder that. As social scientists who work both internationally and domestically, this is Mark Padilla and myself, we're using this paper to interrogate this whole notion of global health a bit more. And we really feel that it should be much better used to integrate the field and really pay attention to the increasing research, to increase research on really the common fundamental causes. We find that, in fact, global health and international health are still used interchangeably to an extraordinary degree. If you look at, here's an example here, and this is not to be unfair to Global Public Health, which is an incredibly valuable journal. It's a sort of flagship journal. They've put out 6 volumes now and 236 peer review articles. So we went through and classified those. And 135 of the 236 describe a health problem in one poor country. 54 of them talk about health problems in several poor countries, and few of those attempt to sort of grapple with a global data or a global perspective of causality. As you see down here on the right-hand side of the slide, there are really a minority of articles that actually deal with rich countries at all. There was one paper here that looked at several, including some poor countries as well. We elaborate on this in the paper a bit more, and we don't want to be misread to suggest that there is not indeed a need for a venue wherein poor countries can describe what's going on in terms of the health of their country and what programs seem to be working or not. Our question is whether that is global public health, and we would argue that it's not global public health, that we need to think about a different sort of unfolding of venues, maybe regional, more online journals, where countries can present and own the research that's describing what's going on in their country, but we would hesitate to suggest this is global public health. So the prompt for this reflection, as we mentioned, was a project we're doing in Detroit. This is funded by the Ford Foundation, and it's really to understand structural conditions that are contributing to sexual vulnerability among youth, including gang members, sex workers, and transgender persons. We find persistent structural convergences in this work between both rich and poor countries in which we've worked previously in the life conditions and the sexual health of young people. That's been sort of the sort of persistent message of our ethnographic experience in the last year. Contrary to any apparent dichotomy between global and domestic health and HIV/AIDS, our research underscores the common structural processes that are affecting young people and making them vulnerable to the epidemic. Underemployment, low state investment in schooling, residential instability, social isolation, racial and gender discrimination, and sexual commerce. No surprise to any of you. Our position, where we contrast the research, is that we want to underscore that the common structural convergences are begging for a much deeper research on things like the psychological and physical toll of sustained underemployment, failed social institutions, and enduring racial or gender discrimination. And we argue that global health remains indeed a valuable critical approach, but not as a geographic paradigm or one focused on the expanding vectors of infection, but rather as an opportunity for all of us to intensify our public health analysis of structural inequality, how this is common to setting after setting after setting, how these are embodied in identity and risk behavior, and how they might be responsive to interventions, or are they going to require, I think we all, many agree, much broader social and political change. So reading Detroit from the Caribbean, how am I doing? Oh, shoot. Okay. I'll be able to only read his section, not mine. Okay. So one co-author of this paper, that's Mark Padilla, has worked for years in the DR, where he's conducted mixed method ethnographic research on sex workers and the tourism industry. And much of his research has used the tourism industry as a lens onto the relationship between political economic factors and sexual vulnerability of the working poor. So inspired by epidemiologic associations between HIV risk and tourism, the work aims to understand this association, but not as a product of the risk behavior of individuals. Rather, as the result of the convergence of numerous structural factors that are combining to create environments in which the most disadvantaged and marginalized are extremely vulnerable economically, but therefore, of course, to sexual commerce, and therefore, certainly to HIV/AIDS, STIs, alcoholism, and drug use. And while most public health approaches to health and tourism-dependent nations have tended to view these as concerns of a result of deficits in the structure of the health services, that we need to have them in tourist centers for the workers, in fact, it's our contention that their vulnerability is really a product of the intersecting economic processes. The stagnancy of employment opportunities in the Caribbean has led to internal demographic changes, with poor people moving en masse to tourism areas to provide informal services to wealthy outsiders. This process is illustrated, this is a map of his, which illustrates the migratory patterns of about 98 men engaged in tourism, sexual tourism, in two cities on the southern coast. So these shifts involving a combination of residential instability, the loss of wage labor, and growths in informalization, including sexual commerce, are all related to what Padilla describes as political trends of heightened vulnerability. The proliferation of these areas are made possible by the abundance of disenfranchised informal workers who provide services, including sex and eroticism, to wealthier, largely white foreign outsiders. I won't go into all he has to say about the state in this regard, except to say that there's a term here, as state pimpage, by some Caribbean social scientists. The relevant point here is that we find so many numerous parallels in the processes in Detroit. As opportunities for wage labor have declined as a result of the restructuring of the global automobile industry, and as the state has consistently decreased funding for education and social services this month again, youth sexual vulnerability appears to have worsened. For 3 years, the highest HIV prevalence rates are among homeless black male youth who report MSM behavior, while teen requests for emergency housing have increased. The exodus of employment opportunities from the city and the decay of the urban infrastructure have left increasingly informalized economy. Across the three communities where we are focusing, Latino youth in Southwest, young women in transactional sex, and transgender youth who are homeless, we observe how the redistribution of poverty, including the redevelopment investments, have generated new patterns of travel and entertainment commerce. that are akin to many of the dynamics described in the Caribbean. For example, major arteries linking the urban core of Detroit to the wealthy, largely white suburbs are also arteries for entertainment commerce, generating historically recent patterns of highly sexualized nightclubs, strip clubs, and with links, and the links to informalized labor is there between those without jobs. There's no security in these clubs with relatively suburban patrons. And I probably do need to stop. Okay. Well, I will tell, we're going to read our paper when it comes out. We have quite a bit on gender burdens in Uganda and how similar they are to women in Detroit. And I'll finish with the last two sentences. Okay. So the intellectual promise, we think, of the glowing interest in global health is precisely that it could encourage us to explore the applicability of causal mechanisms that are identified in one setting to populations suffering from parallel or variant manifestations of the same fundamental causes elsewhere. And while global health is struggling, we feel, with an identity complex, trying to outgrow its role as a platform for where poor countries' health needs are described, which we don't think is global health. We would encourage people to really promote much more cross-national and hybrid models to analyze health issues that self-consciously borrow from research in many locations in order to theorize and deepen our understanding of the health consequences of poverty. Before we lose all our political weapons. Okay, we're done. Thank you.
Thank you.